It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the latest Marquette Law School survey finds Wisconsin voters are still split on the president's job performance and on election 2020. We'll learn more about that and other poll results. First, the institutions called insane asylums in the last century were widely seen as inhumane. And as a society, we might like to think that we've moved past the mistreatment of people living with serious mental illness. But as our next guest writes in his new book, many people suffering with those conditions are still struggling to be treated humanely to get the care that they need. Instead of asylums, they end up in our nation's jails and prisons or often living on the streets. Dr. Kenneth Rosenberg is a psychiatrist, author, and award-winning documentarian who has directed and produced many films, including his upcoming feature-length documentary based on his latest book, Bedlam, An Intimate Journey into America's Mental Health Crisis. Dr. Rosenberg, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here.
This is your professional story, but as you write in the book, this started off as a very personal story in your family. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how it led you into the work that you do?
Absolutely. So when I was 14, my sister, who's 6 years older than me, very, you know, my first best friend, wonderful, kind sister, unfortunately developed schizophrenia, as many people do, in their late teens and early 20s. And as a consequence, my family went through quite a difficult time. And, of course, no one went through more difficult time than my sister, Meryl, who ultimately passed away from schizophrenia. But it was then when I was 14 that I decided, you know, I'm going to become a psychiatrist because I could see how my family was suffering and hopefully help other families with this ordeal. It was also after she passed away in 2005 and really 5 or 6 years later that I decided, well, now I'm a psychiatrist. I need to do more. And for me, that more meant as a filmmaker, I'm also a documentary filmmaker since medical school, I thought I can make a documentary about this. In fact, I need to, because not only just to tell my sister's story, but to tell the story, the untold story of millions upon millions of families and individuals in this country who have languished on the streets, live in the jails, and don't get the care, the resources, the treatment that they deserve as citizens.
And as you point out toward the end of your book, a lot of people dealing with schizophrenia and other serious conditions and their families feel a sense of shame, alienation, a feeling that they're alone. And that's part of what you're trying to tackle here.
Exactly. We're trying to have a conversation that often isn't had because people live in shame and isolation. And we're really trying to break that. You know, our theme for this project is to tell your story. And, of course, that means that I have to tell my own story, the story of my family and the shame that my parents, wonderful, kind, loving people, honestly, in all respects, the best parents you could hope for, but except that they could not accept my sister's serious mental illness. So they hid it from themselves and the community, and my sister lived in denial of the illness. So, yes, we believe that you should have a conversation. If you have a conversation, that breaks the cycle. You know, I'm sure we'll get to it, but the question always comes, what is the one thing we need to change the serious tragedy of those with mental illness in America? And I think the one thing we need is a conversation. And, of course, to have a conversation, you can't fix what you can't face. So we have to face and talk about the mental illness in ourselves and our family members and in our loved ones and in society. You know, we step over those folks on the streets and the stations all over America. We have to start talking about them and talking about ourselves and our families.
Let's talk about what we mean by this phrase. I've used it, you've used it, serious mental illness. It sounds kind of like a generic term, but it does have some a scientific and medical meaning.
Exactly. So 1 in 5 people in America may have a mental illness. 1 in 5 families have to deal with the mental illness. If you look at any mental illness, about 50% of us will need a psychiatric assessment and psychiatric care at some point in our lives. But about 4 or 5% of us need serious treatment, and because we have a serious illness. And what are those illnesses? Schizophrenia, in which we have a thought disorder, in which we hear voices or even see things and have delusions, and renders us pretty dysfunctional, or mood disorders like bipolar disorder, which used to be called manic depression, where you have ups and downs, and also serious personality disorders. Now, serious mental illness affects 4 to 5% of people in this country, but that doesn't even account for people with substance abuse. I'm an addiction psychiatrist, so I consider substance use disorders also as serious mental disorders. But You know, any mental disorder affects about 50% of us, but serious mental illnesses affect at least 4 or 5% of us.
Let's dig into some of the history here. Around the middle of the last century, we went through a big change in the United States in what we do, where we treat or try to treat people with these serious mental illnesses. Can you take us through that transition?
Sure. You know, in the 14th century, we started with the first mental institution, or one of the oldest mental institutions, in Bethlehem, England, and that was called Bedlam. Of course, that's the name of our film. Now, Bedlam has now become synonymous with chaos and uncontrolled, an asylum, essentially. But originally, that was just the nickname for Bethlehem Hospital, or, you know, in Bethlehem, in London. Since then, we've put people in all kinds of places, but in the 1800s, we started building mental institutions, particularly in this country. And by the mid-1900s, there were 558,000 people in those state-run facilities, state-run asylums. They were dreadful, but they did provide a level of housing and care. And then we decided that they were so dreadful, and we had this idea that the new medicines would alleviate the need for these asylums. We decided to tear them down. So that began what we call deinstitutionalization. Deinstitutionalization, taking away those big institutions and replacing them with community mental health centers. A very wonderful idea by President Kennedy, but flawed in many respects. First of all, there weren't that many of them. Secondly, the funding ran out. And thirdly, even the community mental health centers that were there were not able to take care of the sickest patients. So then we really didn't deinstitutionalize folks. We transinstitutionalized them. We put them from one institution, terrible asylums, to a worse institution, the streets, and now the jails. So today in America, the three largest jails in America are also our three largest mental institutions. In some states, you're 10 times more likely to be in a jail than in a hospital if you have a serious mental illness. And we have all kinds of problems with that because we've criminalized mental ill. We've kind of made it a crime to have a mental illness, and we've made the jails, the de facto mental institutions of this country. We still have hospitals, but we have about 2 to 3% of the psychiatric beds that we had in 1955. Yet, mental illness has not exactly gone away since 1955, right? So we've gotten rid of the beds. We have fewer resources. The research has stalled, unfortunately. And we have this terrible problem where people languish in the streets, end up in the jails. And that's the state of affairs, particularly horrible in the major cities, particularly horrible in Los Angeles, which is the epicenter of the crisis.
Talking to Dr. Ken Rosenberg, his new book and upcoming documentary are called Bedlam, An Intimate Journey into America's Mental Health Crisis. Dr. Rosenberg, sorry to interrupt there. You share a lot of stories in your book and your upcoming documentary of people who, you know, part of their mental health story, their trajectory, does involve ending up in the criminal justice system. Can you share some of what you've seen and how that affects them?
Sure. Pardon the beeping here. I'm calling from New York City, and we have a lot of
traffic noise here. We expect beeping from New York.
we've seen many situations, many very difficult situations in which we follow one or two people. Half of the people we follow, of the five or six people we follow for several years, half of them end up in jail. And that's where people with mental illness often end up. They commit small crimes, and sometimes they commit big crimes. Rarely, despite all the headlines, do they hurt anyone. Mostly they hurt themselves, and they make themselves a terrible nuisance. They steal things. They're actually very bad criminals, as criminals go. But they end up in jail, and we saw that in the people we characterized in the film. We didn't intend to find people in jail. We didn't intend to make a film about the jails and write a book about the jails. But that's just where the mentally ill end up in America today.
And if anything, so the causes of these mental illnesses we're talking about, there are many causes, but it's clear from the stories you tell, the way, the experience of being in jail or prison, the way people are treated by guards and other inmates, it is making their mental illnesses even worse in many cases. Is that right?
Exactly. You know, there are many determinants of serious mental illness. First of all, there's a biological predisposition, but that's not all of it. Even the serious illness like schizophrenia has only a 50% what we call penetrance for the disease. In other words, if you have an identical twin who has schizophrenia, you only have a 50% chance of getting that illness, even though you share the exact same DNA. So something else is going on. What else is going on? Well, it could be an environmental toxin. It could be another biological factor. It could have to do with psychological factors. It could have to do with stress. But certainly, we know that poverty, trauma, being in jail does not help your mind whatsoever. Being homeless doesn't help your mind whatsoever. So there are social determinants that exacerbate, if not cause, serious mental illness. The other thing that often is not discussed is the influence of illicit drugs. I'm an addiction psychiatrist, as I said earlier, and I think it's fair to say that sometimes for vulnerable people, illicit continual sustained substance abuse opens a window on serious mental illness that might have otherwise been closed. So there's many factors, but as you say, being in jail, being traumatized does not help and hurts and could be, you know, bring out an illness that otherwise might remain dormant and unseen.
We're talking right now with Dr. Ken Rosenberg. He's a psychiatrist, author, and award-winning documentarian. His latest book is Bedlam, An Intimate Journey into America's Mental Health Crisis. A documentary based on that book will air on the PBS series Independent Lens on April 20th. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or a loved one struggled with a serious mental illness and with getting the right kind of treatment and care? Were incarceration or homelessness part of that story? If you were able to access treatment or support that was useful, what was it? If you work on the other side of things in mental health treatment in a jail or prison setting where you might encounter mental illness, love to hear your story too. Please call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up that conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our talk now with Dr. Ken Rosenberg, psychiatrist, author, and documentary filmmaker. He's directed and produced many films, including his upcoming feature-length documentary based on his latest book, Bedlam, An Intimate Journey into America's Mental Health Crisis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has this been a story for you or in your family? Serious mental illness, homelessness, incarceration? Do you work on the treatment side of things, or have you worked in the criminal justice system where you've seen these problems come through your door and you don't know how to deal with them? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go right to your calls now. We've got Lisa on the line in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Hi. This has been the story of my family for 25 years now. I have a brother. He is up north. He, for the past 25 years, has been in and out of jail and prison. We found that at least in prison, he can be outside sometimes, and there is some form of treatment. Right now, he's in the county jail in northern Wisconsin. He's being tased on a regular basis. He's having delusions, and there's just no help. We've contacted our legislatures. We know this is about rewriting laws, but it's a terrible, terrible thing that's happening all over our country.
Lisa, thank you so much. Sorry for your brother and your family's story. Dr. Rosenberg, it's terrible for him to be in jail, but Lisa says it's the only place he gets any kind of treatment in many cases.
Yeah, Lisa, my heart goes out to you, and that's a story that, of course, I know very well from my own family and my patients and our subjects in the film. The fact that this is the only place that your brother can get treatment is a sad state of mental health care in this country. And the fact that he is tased and tortured is also very, very common. There is help available. We should mention that. There's a National Alliance on Mental Illness. They have chapters in every city. They are enormously helpful and provide lots of direction. They're on the web. You can find them there. In our book, we also talk about practical tips for families. But what we really have to do is change the laws, as Lisa suggests. We need parity for these folks. We need them to be treated as people with brain disorders, not people who need to be punished.
Thanks a lot for that call, Lisa. Good luck to you and your family. We'll go now to Matt, calling for the Western Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Matt, hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Matt?
Well, I'm a 30-year veteran police officer. I've worked mostly in Nashville, but 10 years in the Western UP of Michigan. And it's funny that Dr. Rosenberg and yourself are bringing this subject up, because an administrator and I, we've been talking a long time about mental health issues and how much we don't have access to it, particularly in the UP of Michigan. Sometimes we have to transport
like somebody dealing with a mental health emergency?
Yes, I'm sorry, I just got tongue-tied.
Sure.
Sometimes we have to transport them as far as 11 hours one way downstate. And it's really ridiculous. And then we have the problem that we've been dealing with the last few years of chemical-induced psychoses, such as people dealing, you know, using meth, which is totally, just nuts. Law enforcement, like myself, understand it. The judges see it, but there's no place to put these people. And they're in fairly good numbers, too.
Matt, thanks a lot for that call and sharing your story. And Dr. Rosenberg, I don't have the number in front of me, but in your book, you mentioned the incredible percentage of police time that is doing exactly what Matt was talking about, that transport to emergency mental health treatment.
Yes, good people like Matt are on the front lines in the war on serious mental illness, but people did not go into law enforcement to become social workers, nor are they necessarily trained. I mean, they do a fantastic job. But it's sort of like, you know, if you took all the child care centers and you said they were going to be manned by, you know, doctors or plumbers, we wouldn't know what to do to take care of children. Well, it's the same for law enforcement. They are stuck with this incredible responsibility of taking care of people with serious mental illness. And in fact, 10 to 20% of police time is taken up with transports, just the way Matt described. And that's often why people end up in jails instead of hospitals, by the way, because, you know, it's said that the jail bed is the bed that never says no. Whereas at a hospital, you take someone as a police officer, you take someone to the hospital, you have to wait, you have to go through admissions, you have to stay there, you have to triage them. You can't just drop them off at central booking and go on and do your job and protect the public. So, we should really understand that law enforcement does the best job they can, and they're strapped with this, and we burden them with this as a society, which just, as Matt says, there's nowhere to take them. So, you know, they're put in our hands, and we do the best we can. So, but it's not good enough.
Thanks for the call, Matt. We're talking to Dr. Ken Rosenberg about his new book and upcoming documentary on mental health in America. It's called Bedlam. Back to your calls now. Doug is with us in Appleton. Doug, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Doug?
I just wanted to thank you guys for bringing this to the public's attention. I actually just recently left the hospital. I'm 3 days out. I spent the weekend. And I have a lot of experience with, dealing with the illness. I got diagnosed in 2001, and I've had a bipolar disorder ever since.
And have you had this situation, Doug, where you've ended up in a jail or prison as a result?
Yeah, actually, I got very sick one time, and I was kicked out of a technical institution. I caused a domestic disturbance, was taken down by the cops, caused a lot of trauma to people who were witness to it, and spent a few days in jail. Then I participated in what's called mental health court. I don't know if you're familiar with
sure.
that.
Yes, very much so. We're big fans of mental health court.
And Doug, did you think that mental health court was a good, at least, step in the right direction?
It was definitely a good step in the right direction. I got to know Judge Gill real well, it was a good experience. It helped me to kind of deal with it, and it was a much better alternative to being put into jail or back into an institution.
Doug, thanks a lot for your call and for sharing your story. Dr. Rosenberg, do we have enough things like mental health courts and options for people like Doug for ending up in jail?
No, we don't. But Doug, first of all, thanks for calling and good luck with your care. It sounds like you're really on the right track. Not to mention, you know, we should say that medication helps people, mm-hmm. particularly with bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. And I imagine Doug is reaping the benefits of that. No, we don't have enough mental health courts there, you know, and even if people are in mental health courts and diverted from incarceration to treatment, which is the right thing to do, of course, and we have more of it, but not enough, you know, then the question is, what treatment do they have? Because we not only need mental health courts, which we have few and far between, but we also need wraparound services so that when people are done with a mental health court and diverted into treatment, that we actually have treatment. So one of the people we follow in the film and the book was diverted from jail into a treatment setting. But it took him 4 months, or I should say it took the jail 4 months to find a treatment facility that would accept him. So, you know, we have problems all around. But mental health courts and something called assisted outpatient treatment, we go into that more later. These are good legal remedies to help people with serious mental illness get away from incarceration and get into treatment.
We're talking to Dr. Ken Rosenberg. His latest book is called Bedlam, An Intimate Journey into America's Mental Health Crisis. He's also a documentary filmmaker in addition to being a psychiatrist, and he's got a documentary about Bedlam. It's coming out in a few months. You can watch that on PBS, the American Experience series. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is the story he's telling your story? Have you been through this either for yourself or with a family member? Incarceration, homelessness related to mental illness, or were you able to find treatment that made a difference for you? We'd love to hear your story too. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Excuse me, Independent Lens, not American Experience on PBS. We will talk to Dr. Rosenberg more after the news and maybe hear from you. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Dr. Ken Rosenberg, psychiatrist, author, and award-winning documentarian. His new book is Bedlam, An Intimate Journey into America's Mental Health Crisis. There's a documentary coming out on PBS in April on America's mental health crisis. We'll go back to your calls now. James is with us in Dubuque, Iowa. James, hi.
Hi. How are you today?
Good. What did you want to share with us today, James?
Okay. Back in 2013, I was in a very bad place and had a mental health breakdown and was going to commit suicide. I was going to shoot myself with a handgun. The police got involved into the situation, and for me, I was very, very fortunate because the officers arrived and they were able to de-escalate the situation. The main officer talked with me at a distance and at a safe distance. And after an hour of conversation with the policeman, I was able to lay down my gun. And then the police took me directly to the hospital. They did not arrest me. They did not handcuff me. They kept things so that I would not escalate into a further bad situation. And I have always felt very fortunate that the Dubuque Police Department were able to have a program where they have trained their officers to recognize situations and to have people trained to de-escalate bad situations.
Wow.
And since then, I have been released from the hospital. Of course, I spent a week in the hospital, and I have gotten involved with NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and have become a connections facilitator I also have been trained now in the peer-to-peer program to help people with who suffer from mental illness learn how to cope with their mental illness and give them hope to become productive people. And I also am trained in the In Our Own Voice program, where we actually talk about our mental health issues in front of an audience, whether it's the Rotary Club, a church organization, or whatever.
James, thank you so much for the call. I want to bring Dr. Rosenberg back, and thank you so much for sharing that story. Dr. Rosenberg, where do you want to go with that amazing story?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for calling, James. And I think that he shows and demonstrates very clearly that there's a lot of hope out there. You know, we're talking about how the system is broken and needs to be fixed, but there's a lot that goes on that's correct. And one of the things is that treatment helps. Treatment saves lives. And good providers, and I'll include the officers who really saved his life, you know, they treatment really can save your life. So I don't want folks listening to think that, you know, the situation's bleak. It's just we need to change the mental health care delivery system in this country. But what's there in terms of psychiatric care, what's there in terms of the National Alliance on Mental Illness and the peer-to-peer program that he's a part of, which is extremely effective. You know, if you've been in that situation, you know better how to help people. I mean, there's a lot of hope out there, and I really appreciate that caller.
Thank you again for calling in to share that. So we'll go to Kylie now with us in Sparta. Kylie, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Kylie?
For me, the big problem was that I was misdiagnosed. I was first diagnosed late teens, early 20s, with borderline personality disorder, and not until my late 30s did I get the proper testing and found that, in fact, I was on the autism spectrum, and I did not have borderline. And the two are treated very, very differently and almost oppositely, and it caused a lot of issues for me with if they thought I needed to go to the hospital or there was police involvement, I could not communicate well with them. It was overstimulating, and which caused more problems, but they didn't know what was wrong. And in the hospital itself, I was treated almost the opposite that I should have been treated. And with proper diagnosis, I have very minimal issues as far as where I need help brought in.
Kylie, I want to jump in because we just have a few minutes left with Dr. Rosenberg. I'm glad you got the right diagnosis, Kylie, and I'm glad that's helping you. It sounds like a lot. Dr. Rosenberg.
Well, Kylie, thanks for the call. And you bring up a couple of really important issues that proper diagnosis and proper treatment is really key. You don't want to end up on the wrong medicine, the wrong therapy, and the wrong place. You also bring up a point which is very useful to share with listeners, which is early intervention is very important. We need more medicines. We need better treatments. We need more beds. But if we had not a single new treatment available and we intervened early in the illness and people got the right treatment they needed early on, we would create a much better situation and save literally millions of lives.
Kylie, thanks again for that call. Dr. Rosenberg, want to talk about another issue that comes up in your book and elsewhere, how people are treated in the system or not treated in the system sometimes based on their race. What do you see there?
Right. Well, unfortunately, people of color are given worse diagnoses, and they're more often sent to a person of color is more often sent to an incarceration situation, to jail or prison, and then sent to treatment compared to a non-person of color. So as there is structural racism in our entire society, it exists in the mental health profession, where a fraction of the professionals are African American, for instance. That is changing, and we now have more diversification in the mental health care delivery system among the psychiatrists, among the medical staff. But for the longest time, it was white men treating most of the folks, and they weren't all white men, so they weren't really poorly, the patients were not properly understood for their cultural diversity. And we see, of course, that with the police. We know the police are in a very, very difficult situation. But if you're a person of color, you're more often, treated poorly, unfortunately, if you have a serious mental illness. So it's not a fair system.
And I wanted to come back to something you touched on earlier, this idea of AOT, the assisted outpatient treatment.
Yes, assisted outpatient treatment is different from mental health courts. In mental health courts, you have to commit a crime, and then the judge says, you know what, you need treatment, not incarceration. With assisted outpatient treatment, if you have a history of repeated and failed hospitalizations, or you're non-compliant with treatment, meaning you don't take your medicines that can really change and save your life, then it is possible for the court to say you must be in treatment or you have to be in a hospital. If you're not in a reasonable treatment, an outpatient treatment, we have the ability to put you in a hospital. And that is a very, very important thing because, we don't want to take away people's rights and we don't want to compromise their civil liberties. But as one mother told me, and we report about this in the book, she said, my son died from a serious mental illness, and he died with his civil liberties intact, meaning it was very impossible to put them in the hospital, him in the hospital, impossible to keep him in the hospital, because his civil liberties were respected, as they should be, but at the same time, his mental illness was running the show. So assisted outpatient treatment means you can get someone into treatment without requiring that they commit a crime. And, of course, how ridiculous is that? To get treatment, you have to commit a crime.
In our last couple minutes, we started with your family story and your sister's story. This is a running theme in your book. So many people involved in treatment and research had that family member themselves, or at least in one case had a serious mental illness herself. We heard from a caller who survived that near suicide event and now is out there helping other people. It sounds like a lot of the solutions here, Dr. Rosenberg, are going to come from people who have dealt with this issue firsthand.
Yeah, exactly. Unfortunately, those are the people who care, the people who have been touched by it personally. And even then, many of us who have been touched by it personally, whether in ourselves or in our loved ones, keep it a secret. And getting back to why I wrote the book and why, with my producer Peter Miller and with my co-writer Jessica DeLong, we did the book and film. We did it because we want to change the conversation. In fact, we want to have a conversation because you can't fix what you can face. We say that over and over again in the book and in the film, and I think this session that we're having with your listeners is evidence of that. People are now talking about it. I think we're at a watershed moment when America is listening and America is changing.
Dr. Rosenberg, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Dr. Ken Rosenberg, psychiatrist, author, and award-winning documentarian who directed and produced many films, including his upcoming feature-length documentary based on his latest book, Bedlam, An Intimate Journey into America's Mental Health Crisis. The film will show an independent lens on PBS that's scheduled for April 20th. The Marquette Law School released its latest poll of Wisconsin voters yesterday. The poll asked voters statewide about a whole host of issues ranging from approval or disapproval of the Trump administration's foreign policy record. Pollsters also asked about the field of Democratic presidential hopefuls as we head into the 2020 primary seasons. In many ways, opinions haven't changed too much from previous polls conducted by the law school. Charles Franklin is a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette Law School Poll. He's also co-founder of Pollster.com and the founder of PollsandVotes.com. Charles, welcome back to the show.
Good afternoon, Rob. Good to be here.
Well, the more things change, the more they stay the same, it looks like, at least in recent Marquette Law School surveys, right? A lot of the big issues, we're seeing a lot of not movement.
I think it's right. Maybe people paid more attention to the holidays over the last month than they did to politics, because not much has moved.
So sum up some of the big top line findings for us when it comes to things like approval of President Trump.
Sure. Approval of Trump is very little change from December. It's 48% approve, 49% disapprove. It was 47-50 in December, so just a point each way. However, that is only the second time of his term that he's fallen below 50% disapproval, and it matches the closest he's come to dead even on this net approval at one point net negative. If you look at him over the whole year, each month, month to month, we've seen no more than a one-point move. But cumulatively over the course of the year, he's a little bit better off now than he was in January a year ago. His economic approval rating is pretty good, 55-42 approve. That's by far his strongest approval. And the weakest is on foreign policy, where it's 44% approve, 53 disapprove. So that's the picture of Trump job approval today.
And that's the foreign policy issue one people were looking at. This was after, I think you were in the field after the Iran military strike?
Yes.
And did that seem, and of course it's hard to pin anything to one particular issue, but did that seem to move any needles when it came to his foreign policy performance?
It really did not move the needle. In December, it was 43-54. 44-53 this time. Again, just barely a point in each direction. Usually when a foreign event happens, whether it's good or bad, the president often will get a bump from a foreign military event. That's not happened here. We were in the field after the drone strike that killed the Iranian general and after the Iranian missile strike on a U.S. base in Iraq. And also after the president's statement the day after the missile strike saying that the U.S. wasn't going to retaliate. That is clear in our data, where 61% believe that it's likely we will not escalate the military conflict there. Only 30% think it's likely that we will have a bigger military conflict with Iran. Also, in terms of the action itself, we asked, do you agree or disagree that it's about time the U.S. hit Iran back? 43% said it was about time, but 51% said it was not. So that suggests not much appetite for military conflict with Iran, though a significant minority that was pleased about it.
Now, one idea with President Trump and his approval or disapproval. Here's a hypothesis. Tell me what you think. There's a lot of data out there about President Trump. Most people have already made up their minds, and it would take something really big to sway it one way or another. Fair?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And the history of the last 3 years, of both in state approval and in national approval, is how little his job approval has moved up and down, especially after the first 6 or 8 months of his term. It's just been remarkably stable, with less than 10% of Democrats approving and somewhere around over 80%, 85% of Republicans approving of Trump. It's just not left much room for movement. The other thing going into 2020 is that now people are pretty sure about what President Trump is like, whereas in 2016, he was the wild card that people didn't know what he would be like as president. And so that's also something that's different coming into this year compared to where we were 3 years ago.
Talking to Charles Franklin about the new Marquette Law School poll. How about the Democratic primary race? We've got Iowa voting just around the corner. What did people in Wisconsin have to say about that field?
A lot of stability there. Biden in first place, Sanders in second, Buttigieg third, and Warren just 1 point behind Buttigieg in fourth place. We've seen those same in the same four as the top four since October, over the last 4 months, without any change really in that. Then it drops down to under 10%, 6% for Bloomberg and 6% for Yang, 4% for Klobuchar. 60% still say they might change their mind. That's down just a little from 65% a month ago. So maybe people are beginning to make up their minds a little bit. But the real thing is going to happen when Iowa votes in just over 2 weeks. With Iowa voting and then New Hampshire, when we look at this in February, there will be a lot more information and almost surely a lot more scrambling of the field compared to where we've been, this real stability throughout the fall.
That's all federal politics. How about state issues? Anything that you focused in on in this month's survey?
I think there were a couple of things. We asked about Foxconn. 35% think the project will be worth the money the state's putting into it. 46% say we're paying too much. But there's been a bump up to 19% who say they don't know. Partly that's because Foxconn hasn't been in the news a lot. But it may also reflect the fact that there's real uncertainty about whether the project will turn out or not. We also saw that majorities, 59%, are either satisfied or very satisfied with their public schools in their community. About a third, 33%, dissatisfied. Strong satisfaction, though, has trended down a little bit over the last couple of years, and some degree of dissatisfaction has trended up a little bit. So the balance is still pretty satisfied, but it's not quite as strong as it has been. And also related to schools, 41% would like their property taxes cut versus 55% who would prefer that money to go to schools. That also is still strongly net positive for schools, but not quite as strong as it was a couple of years ago. So maybe a little bit of shifting in perceptions of schools and giving them a priority.
How about approval ratings for statewide elected office? I think you've got the governor and both U.S. senators on the list.
Yes. Governor Evers' job approval is pretty much where it was last month, 51-40, a plus 11 net approval. It was plus 12 last month, so not much change there. Senator Johnson has a 39 favorable, 29 unfavorable, but as we see with him in all surveys, full 31% say they don't know enough about him to give a rating. Tammy Baldwin is 44 favorable, 40 unfavorable, and about half the don't know rate, 15% don't have an opinion about her. Those differences in don't know have been very consistent between Johnson and Baldwin over the last 5 or 6 years.
Do our Wisconsin elected officials have that extreme partisan polarization in opinions that you pointed out with President Trump?
It's pretty strong, but nothing is as strong as Trump. Evers doesn't get a lot of Republican support, but benefits from some independent support. And with the senators, it's pretty polarized, but again, not to the degree that that Trump polarizes or the extent to which Scott Walker, when he was governor, polarized the electorate.
What are you going to be watching for over the next couple months as we wrap up our last minute, Charles, when it comes to public opinion?
I think the big thing is the scramble for the Democratic nomination and where we are as we go into our April primary. And I'm also going to be watching the economy and people's views of the economy. In early 2019, people were a little pessimistic, but we ended the year with rising optimism about the economy. That's something that's helping President Trump at this point as well.
And, of course, the field will likely change after Iowa and New Hampshire. I know you've been polling second choices among Democratic candidates. Briefly, anything leap out to you there?
There, it's, again, basically the same top four, and people's second choices tend to spread across the field. There's not like, the second choices are overwhelmingly one candidate. So, again, I think the field is just pretty fluid. And people will shift and settle on a first choice after they see who's in the top two or maybe the top three after we get the first round of voting in February.
Charles, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Charles Franklin is a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director there of the Marquette Law School Poll. He's also the co-founder of Pollster.com and founder of PollsandVotes.com. He joins us today to talk about their latest survey just out yesterday. It asked Wisconsin voters about the Trump administration's foreign policy record, the Democratic presidential hopefuls, and a whole bunch of other national and state issues and public figures. Where were you in January of the year 2000? I was here at work, I reckon, but if you happen to be a lactobacillus bacteria, you might have been hard at work on a cheddar cheese that's just now going up for sale. Hook's, the Wisconsin cheese company, is releasing a 20-year-age cheddar priced to move at $209 a pound. Central Time producer and former cheesemonger Dean Knetter is here. Hey, Dean.
Hey, Rob.
Now, I understand the last time around, they've done this before, you got to taste some of the 20-year cheddar.
I did. I was working as a cheesemonger at the time, which was a good avenue to get this cheese.
Yeah. And so what is it? So a lot of us might have had, you know, the mild, the medium, the sharp, maybe 1, 3, 5 year cheddars, 20 year.
It is sharp. We get that out of the way right
Painfully
away.
Painfully sharp?
It is sharp. However, I think it does mellow out as it goes through that 10, 15 year period, because my reaction when I had it, knowing that it was going to be sharp, was actually, that is quite smooth.
Yeah, and I've heard that, because like 10, like sometimes 12 is pushing it for me, but I've heard rumors that it can start to mellow out after that peak sharpness.
There was a little bit of like a buttery flavor to it. It wasn't quite as intense as I thought it was. Really delicious.
Yeah. This is good sandwich making cheese. You melt it over broccoli?
No, don't do that. If I see that, Rob.
You'll slap that cheese out of my hand.
Yeah, definitely.
And rightfully so. Thanks, Dean.
You bet.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.